James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Begin countdown. Six, five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, coming to you from the Blue Waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida, all around the country and through the World Wide Web, all around the world as well. Welcome to everybody, both domestic and overseas. Glad to have all of you along with us here on the program today. A big day for a lot of people, especially a big day for folks named Clinton, Obama, McCain, Romney, and Huckabee. Big day for those folks. It remains to be seen how big. It'll be interesting to see how the day turns out. Lots of pollsters. I think it will be interesting. We're going to find out one thing. I'll tell you this much. The final polls forecast for today, California and Missouri, for example. We've got the Survey USA in California that has Clinton ahead 52-42 over Obama. Zogby has Obama leading Clinton 49-36. Now, there's a big disparity there. And Survey USA in Missouri has Clinton with 54 and Obama 43. Zogby has Obama 45, Clinton 42. So that will be interesting to see how those go along today. Somebody's going to be really, really off the mark between those two pollsters today. But it's finally here, Super Tuesday. I know everybody will be glued to the tube all evening long, you know, get out your popcorn, get ready to listen to Russert and Tweety drone on all evening long, and as the old drinking game says on an election eve, have a drink every time you say, how's it go? Have a drink every time you hear the phrase, too close to call. You'd be drunk probably by 8:30. It'll go on long into the night. Of course, we're all waiting to see how California goes. Their polls probably, let me see, I don't know this for a fact, but most likely close around 8 o'clock. That would be 11 o'clock our time here. By the time I get a decent count, it's going to be midnight or later. So it's going to be a long, long evening for many, many folks. I get up really early. I don't know. I suppose I'll be up watching. Although, it remains to be seen if this is going to be one of those definitive days where we find out who the nominee is going to be in either party. I don't know. I think it's more likely we find out that McCain will win the Republican nomination than it is Obama or Hillary will win the Democratic nomination. I think that's more likely. We're going to have Stephen Hill with us coming up at the bottom of the hour. Stephen is the director of the Political Reform Program at New America Foundation. And we're going to talk about the primary process and his latest piece is why Tuesday won't be so super. And in it, he says, having a single primary day with so many states gives great advantage to those candidates with the most campaign cash and name recognition to compete in so many states simultaneously. Hardly super-duper. He says this fiasco should be called Super Stupid Tuesday. And we'll talk to Stephen about that coming up at the bottom of this hour. He had a big piece in the Wall Street Journal, what was that, just a couple of days ago. Maybe today. Well, anyway, just a couple of days ago. And in the second hour, at the bottom of the second hour, we're going to have Francis Fox Piven with us. Francis is going to talk about this new budget that Junior Bush has come up with that naturally throws a whole hell of a lot more money toward the Pentagon and less toward services needed in this country by our own citizens. I'm taking a look at the stock market at the present time. The Dow is down 321 points. Just getting hammered today. 321 points. Of course, there's 54 minutes yet. Maybe it'll come back today. Today's the anniversary. 5 long years ago, particularly if you're in the military, or if you've got loved ones in the military, 5 years ago, Colin Powell, Bush lackey, a man that I used to respect but lost all respect for shortly after 5 years ago today. 5 years ago, Colin Powell made that famous statement, "My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence, and the rest is history." He went on to paint a horror story of WMDs under every rock and in Iraq. He went on to tell us how Saddam was poised to destroy the entire Middle East. He went on to tell us about drones and all the things that Saddam Hussein can do to us and the rockets that they had, blah, 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 blah. This man primarily armed by the United States of America, this good friend of Bush 1 administration, Donald Rumsfeld. 5 years ago today, Colin Powell helped to destroy the reputation of the United States of America on the world stage, and he did it on the world stage at the United Nations. I cannot forgive Colin Powell for what he did that day. He was supposed to be a man of some intelligence, some intellect. Instead, we found out he was nothing more than a bootlicker. That's exactly what he was that day. He did irreparable harm to the country that he'd served for so many years. Just unforgivable. It really is. On a not-so-serious note for a moment, don't forget again to have, and I wonder how many of you know what I'm talking about here when I say punchkis. Don't forget to have your punchkis today. How many of you know what that is? Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, some of you do know. It's a Polish pastry, kind of like a beignet you would get down in New Orleans. Only these are filled with fruit or prunes or, you know, whatever, jelly. And it's a Polish Catholic tradition. Pastry is traditional for the day before Lent or Fat Tuesday for a lot of people. These things are especially popular in Northwest Ohio and I guess Chicago too. So, don't forget, if you haven't gotten them yet, be sure and get out and get your punchies today. It's like a fruit-filled donut, okay? Like some of us would call a Bismarck. You know what I mean? Donut without the hole, filled with jelly filling. Kind of like that. You roll them in powdered sugar, or you can glaze them. Make me hungry just thinking about it. So if you haven't had your punchies today, be sure and get them. Hamtramck, Michigan, big Polish community up there. Chicago, of course, second largest Polish populous city in the world. And don't forget Northwest Ohio. Lots of Polish people there having their punchies today. What do you think is going to happen today? And oh, by the way, I did want to mention we know things are going swimmingly in Baghdad and in Iraq. We're told that constantly by our beloved President of the United States. I say beloved because his latest poll, the CBS News poll, Bush's job approval, 27%. 27. 65% of the people disapprove of him. 27% approval rate. And this man has the nerve to even go out in public. This man has the temerity to think that anybody listens to him. This man has the guts to try and preserve whatever kind of a legacy that he thinks he has. And make no mistake, he does think he has a legacy worth protecting. Oh my God. That in and of itself would show me that the man doesn't have the sense he was born with. His family must be so proud. So very proud. Mama Bush, Babs baby. Well, I don't know. How's that working out for you, Babs? Not so well. But here we are on Super Tuesday. Everybody running for the presidency today. 20-some-odd states. What is it, 24? I heard 24, I heard 21. I look at the map, I didn't actually count them up. We've got some winner-take-all. We've got some that divide them. We've got some where independents can vote and some where independents can't vote. I was going to try and explain that whole thing today, but we don't have enough time. In the areas where if you win 51-49 and there's three delegates available, it gets 2-1. But if you beat them 65-27 or whatever, you get three votes. The other one gets, I don't know. It's the most unbelievable thing trying to figure this all out. I saw Terry McAuliffe trying to explain it today. Not so much to explain it, defend it, actually. He really didn't do a very good job. I had a discussion about Terry McAuliffe. You know, he's the former chairman of the DNC. Delightful guy to be around. He really is. But I had never met the guy. And I was in Washington one time several years back. And Candy Stroud from the DNC, who was the radio coordinator at the time, took me into Terry's office to introduce me to him to do an interview. And having never met the man, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what a live wire he really was. Anyway, he opened up the door. We walked in, and Candy said, Mr. Chairman, this is Guy James from the Guy James Show. He jumps up out of his chair, extends his hand, and says, my gosh, Guy, how have you been? How are you? And he went on and on and on. And so I sat down, and I did the interview, and walked out of the room after it was over with, and Candy looked at me and said, oh, you already knew him. I said, no, I never met the man in my life. That's just the way he is. He's a live wire. We were talking about him at the conference I was at a couple of weeks ago, and folks from the DNC were saying that he was a guy that came to work high energy in the morning and left high energy at night. See, he was on all the time. They never saw him down. They never saw him quiet. He was always just go, 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 and always up and just energy charged, just ready to rock and roll at all times. Howard Dean is a bit different than that. So, anyway, just an interesting aside to the way some of these people are. Talking about, we have the Republicans, McCain and Romney, talking about how great the surge has been. McCain actually saying that the surge has been good for his campaign because he was one of the prognosticators who said it would be such a good thing to have the surge. And, of course, the surge is doing so well. So well. Never mind that the Mahdi army has kind of thrown their truce aside and we're starting to see all these bombings take place. Never mind that we had the mass bombing, what was it, last, I don't know, Friday, Saturday? God knows how many dozen people were killed once again right in the downtown Baghdad at some of the markets, a couple of pet markets within moments of one another. Found a mass grave today outside of Baghdad with about 50 bodies in it, some of them very recent. So that's working out very well. Very, very well. The surge is doing a good job. You know what that surge is doing? All that surge did was separate the Sunnis from the Shias. Actually segregated them. Didn't do a thing toward healing their differences. Didn't do a thing toward establishing a permanent government, a representative government, a stable government in Iraq. Didn't do anything for that. Nor will it. But we have the Republicans running on it. How would you like to be a member of the United States military right now? Now, forget all the bull crap you hear from the politicians that go over there, particularly Republican politicians, to say they haven't talked to a single person over there, didn't think the thing was just going great. They haven't talked to a single person over there, just wasn't very proud to be there and just loved it. That's what you hear from the Republicans coming back from there, every damn one of them, particularly John McCain. But how would you like to be a member of the United States military right now? Here you are stuck in Iraq or Afghanistan. There's an election going on back home. And nobody is talking about you. Sorry, pal, you just aren't important right now. See, there was this surge. And it went so well that everything is okay in Iraq now. We're sending all our troops home very soon. Oh, we're not? The flowers are blooming. Everyone's got a job. Everybody's got plenty of money in Iraq. Got plenty of electricity. The sewer system and the water system, everything working just fine. The Shia and the Sunnis are getting along just fine. And the Kurds, well, the Kurds are safe and sound. Perfectly secure. They're very happy as well. Making their own oil deals with everybody. Wouldn't it be comforting to know, if you're a soldier in Iraq, that the politicians back home are talking about you every minute? You're in the hearts and minds of all the politicians at all times. You're the number one concern of our political leaders, and their main thought is figuring out how to get you home right way. Oh, wait. You mean your well-being as a member of the U.S. military is not at the forefront of the national debate by the politicians? Really? The real talk from the Republican politicians is how much everybody hates John McCain. Ann Coulter's received more press about her hatred of McCain than your buddies have been getting killed in Iraq. That's right. There was more press about Ann Coulter saying she hated John McCain and would campaign for Hillary Clinton than there was about a couple of our soldiers getting killed in Iraq. Now, how's that? How's that for good news? How's that for supporting the troops? How's that for the mainstream media taking care of our boys and girls over in Iraq, huh? And the Democrats. Frankly, they've talked more about passing a damn stimulus bill with $300 checks for everyone than they have about solving the problem in Iraq lately. Oh, there's been mention of it. It ought to be at the forefront. Every time they open their mouths, that ought to be the first thing that comes out of them. Is the economy important? Yes, it is. Is the immigration problem important? Yes, it is. Education, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all those things are important. But the number one burning issue of our time, of our day, is this war in Iraq. And it ought to be the first damn thing to come out of the mouth of every politician, everywhere they go. But if you're a soldier over there right now, you're willing to wear the uniform of the United States of America. You know, certainly the press is pushing the war to the top of the news every day, right? Right? No? It's a disgrace. Absolutely a disgrace. What can I say? We're going to pause for a break right now. We'll be right back.
Hello, Ralph Nader. We are Anonymous. Over the years, we have been watching you, your campaigns, your dissent, your litigious nature. You gave us OSHA and the EPA and seatbelts. We freaking love seatbelts. When you ran in 2000, it seemed like a pretty cool idea. A chance for a third party. Some of us got behind you. I don't remember. How did it turn out? Oh, that's right. It kind of sucked. That's not really your fault. Those bastards were probably going to steal it anyway. Your fans felt embarrassed. We went underground. We became anonymous. We told ourselves that the lesser of two evils would have still been evil, or some horse shit like that. But Ralph, if you run this time, you can stick those seat belts where the minimum wage don't shine. No, seriously, don't even. And it's not that bad. Doesn't Obama make you cry sometimes? He totally makes us cry sometimes. But maybe that's the lesson of 2000. Vote strategically and practically, not as an expression of emotion or high-minded principle. But still, Obama totally makes us cry sometimes. Anywho, keep speaking your mind. You have a lot to be proud of. But regarding the campaign, here are your laurels. Why don't you lie down on them and take a goddamn nap for once? We are anonymous. We are legion. We do not forget. Expect us not to lift a finger to help you out. I'm some dude you never heard of, and I approve this message.
Some kind of way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. It's too much confusion, and I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them alone. What any of it's worth. No reason to get excited. The thief, he kindly spoke. There are many here among us. But a joke. But you and I, we've been through all that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now. The hour is getting late.
Guy James back with you here on the Guy James Show, Head On Radio Network, Billy Shears, music director. Welcome to the program. In just a few minutes, we'll take a break and hook up with Stephen Hill, director of political reform program at the New American Foundation. going to have something to say about primaries and how we run them and how crazy they've become. That coming up in about 5 minutes from now. You're welcome to give us a call at 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. I don't know how many of you get correspondence daily from the DNC and all that sort of thing. I do. I'm not so sure whether I want correspondence from them every day. Sometimes I'm sorry I got it. But the Democratic National Convention Committee sent me some correspondence last week. Friday. And it informed me that they're very proud that AT&T was going to be our informational technology people at the convention. They're going to provide the phones and the internet and everything. Isn't that wonderful? At the same time, our government's thinking about giving them immunity for intrusions into our privacy. I thought, well, isn't that swell? AT&T. Here they are. Congress thinking about, slugging it out. Actually, not slugging it out. You know, the Democrats will capitulate over that if they haven't already today. Haven't checked in the last hour or two. But you know they'll give in, and they'll give them immunity. You know they will. The IT, internet technology companies, they'll get the immunity. But I called and complained, and they said they'd get back to me, and they haven't. My goodness, what do you know about that? Democratic National Convention Committee. Planning on attending that convention. And I thought, well, of course, they'll want to call me back and get the approval for AT&T, and I won't give them to them, and give it to them, and we'll have to get somebody else. Boy, am I dreaming. Love the conservative logic that's going around. Really. Everybody snickers at the far, far left who took down Lieberman for not being with us on the war. But it looks to me like they've got just as serious a problem over on the far right as well. And they're getting a lot of press. Ann Coulter is the perfect example right now. This is a woman who's made her fortune by presenting herself as a conservative hardliner on abortion. She talks about abortion every chance she gets. It's always included in her conversation. She has said repeatedly that abortion is murder, yada, 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 yada. I'm not making light of abortion. I don't like abortion either. I don't know anybody that does. So the difference between pro-life and pro-choice is not that one side likes abortion and the other one doesn't. That's not the point. But now she's going to throw a tantrum if her favorite candidate doesn't get nominated and go campaign for hardcore pro-choice politician? That's right. Annie the Man Coulter says she will campaign for Hillary Clinton, somebody she knows is pro-choice, after all these years of cutting down the left because of their stance on abortion, because her favorite candidate doesn't get nominated, Romney, she's going to go campaign for Hillary, she said. I mean, wouldn't that make her something like an accessory to murder in using her own logic? Not my logic, using hers. I don't know. Just seems a bit strange to me. Just a wee bit strange. I could be wrong. Anyway, we're coming up to the time where we're going to take another break, and we're going to get a hold of our first guest coming up today, Stephen Hill, and we'll come back in just a moment or two, so don't go away.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune into Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texans liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
And if you want another kind of love, I'll wear a mask for you. Strike me down in anger. Here I stand.
miss Rick's Place with Rick Goodner, part of the weekend lineup on the Horn, running all weekend in rotation with the Showers Report and Night Sounds. I was dipping to the
ring for you. Round up the usual suspects.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Rick Goodner, part of the Weekend Wrecking Crew. And I'm here to tell you that you cannot miss Billy Shears. The man knows his music. The man knows what you're thinking. Tune in and listen. You'll be surprised. He's going to play the very song that you were thinking that you needed to hear. He's a genius. Maybe a bit psychic. I promise you. Tune in on the weekend, listen to Billy Shears Night Sounds, and you will hear the song you've been waiting to hear. And you'll enjoy your time as much as I do. Right here on the Horn Head On Radio Network. Make sure you don't miss what you've been waiting to hear with Billy Shear.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Play as time goes by.
And we're back. Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show, and thank you for joining us on this Super Tuesday. Some people think it's super, some people don't. And right now, I'd like to welcome to our program someone that's got a lot to say about it, and I think you'll enjoy hearing from Stephen Hill. Stephen is the director of the Political Reform Program at the New American Foundation, and he's got a few bones to pick with the primary system we have. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Guy. Nice to be here.
As you know, there's probably been more falderal about the primary season this year than ever before. Probably 10 times more than the cumulative total of all the years that I can remember.
Yes, I think what's spurring that is, you know, all the states have an incentive to leapfrog each other and move their dates ever closer to New Year's Day in order to not be left out of the process. And every state wants to be influential to some degree on who the nominees are. And it's just simply the case that we've seen this steady progression of states leapfrogging each other. We saw this year the states of Florida and Michigan jumping forward into the month of January, even though the Democratic Party forbade them from doing so, and they said, we're doing it anyway, we're tired of being left out of this process. And so that caused the Democrats to say, well, we're not going to count the delegates from Michigan and Florida, which could end up hurting the ultimate Democratic nominee. So this has been a long-standing issue, and it just got even worse this year than previous years.
I happen to live in Florida, and it's been a big thing in the news, and everybody feels disenfranchised. I was surprised at the turnout by the Democrats, but it didn't hurt that we had a big tax issue on the ballot this year as well, so I'm sure that had something to do with the turnout. I saw Terry McAuliffe this morning, attempting anyway to defend the primary process and what has happened over the years and the tradition of it and so forth. And really, I don't think he convinced anybody. I know, Stephen, that you've got some ideas about the primary and maybe a completely different way of doing it. And I've read your article, what was it, in the Washington Post? What was it, Saturday's issue, was it?
Yes, Saturday, right.
You've got some great ideas, and I have to say I completely agree with some of the things you said about wanting to make him kind of regional contest. Would you explain what you're talking about in that?
Sure. I mean, you know, the situation as it is has led to this situation where some have called it Super Duper Tuesday. I've called it Super Stupid Tuesday, because not only do you have this leapfrogging in some states being left out, but it led to 24 states having their primary or their caucuses on a single day. And it made today, February 5th, into essentially a wealth primary, where if you as a candidate didn't have sufficient financial resources to compete in 24 primaries simultaneously, you know, and then we're talking large states, mid-sized states, small states scattered across the country, then you just dropped out. And that's why I think there's no question that John Edwards dropped out, because he simply didn't have the resources he felt to compete in Super Tuesday. Same with Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson. So we've seen the restriction of voters' choices. Some voters have already voted in some of these primaries for the candidates who have dropped out, and so they have been completely they've lost their vote in this process. So a much better way to do it than this Super Stupid Tuesday would be having a series of four separate primary days, each approximately a month apart, starting, you know, perhaps in March. So March, April, May, June, one per month. And in the first primary in March, you'd have the 13 smallest states, lowest population states, that would all go at the same time. So New Hampshire would still have its first-in-the-nation status, but it would share it with Rhode Island, with Wyoming, with North Dakota, South Dakota, and letting the smallest states go first. Then a month later, approximately, you'd have the next 13 largest states going, followed the following month by the mid-sized states, and finally, in the final month in June, would be the largest states. And the advantage of doing it this way is that in most years, the nomination process would not be over until the final election, because that's when the 12 or 13 largest states would go, and there would be the most delegates up for grabs. And so that means that all states and all voters, no matter your size, no matter the part of the country you live, would have an opportunity to weigh in and be part of this nomination process. Whereas now, the way it's happening, you know, some states are ignored, voters don't get to really participate, and this nomination process could be over very shortly. So, in 2004, when John Kerry won Super Tuesday, the nomination process essentially was over in February of that year, and all the other states were pretty much left out, leading to this leapfrogging that we saw this year. So this is the type of process that really would allow voters to feel like they're engaged. And also, by getting it over in June in the fashion that I described, there wouldn't be such a downtime between the point at which the nominee is known and then the nominating conventions that don't take place until the end of the summer. You'd have more of a process where, you know, voters and the public and the media could stay engaged right through to the end of the process, to the presidential election, instead of having these downtimes that we have now. So I think that this would be the type of process that would really make it a lot better.
Well, and we would have everybody involved. Even the small states could not complain that they didn't get their voice, because they would. And by the time we got up to the large states, which would seal the deal for somebody, everybody would have said their piece, and it wouldn't end up with a situation like we possibly have right now. It doesn't matter who you're for in this thing, but if somebody, and I'll just use Obama as an example right now. He's got the hot hand right now. Somebody can come in on one day with a hot hand, everything going his way, or if it was Hillary, it didn't make any difference, and clean out that particular day, and the party's over. It just seems much more logical and much more fair to divide it up regionally, like you have mentioned.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and by doing it this way also, there's a different type of campaign that goes on in these smaller states, in New Hampshire, you know, the retail politicking, as it calls, the door-to-door and the handshaking and that kind of thing. And we want to encourage that, because that's a good for democracy. But in the larger states, it's more difficult to do that because the states are so large. So by doing it this way, where the small states go first, you'd have that retail politicking, you'd get that look at the candidates, the personable quality of it. And then in the larger states, where it's more, it becomes a media wars, and you know, it's more of a, to some degree, a battle of positioning of ideas and what have you, you'd get that too. So it would create a nice mix, and it would allow the public to have a longer look at these candidates, because right now what we're facing is, you know, we've had most candidates dropping out after only a handful of states have weighed in, and those states have not been very large states. They've been states like South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, on the Democratic side. The Republican side did have Florida and Michigan. But you know, it's been just a handful of states, and most of the candidates have dropped out at this point. So by having the method I described, where you'd have four separate primaries, each one escalating in terms of the size of the states, it would allow candidates who start out perhaps slowly, but have a type of politicking that catches fire as they gather momentum. It would allow them to have a shot instead of being out of the game so quickly.
Wouldn't we be talking about public financing with all this, that to allow someone to stay the course throughout the whole thing and stay on through the big states at the end?
Sure, public financing of campaigns, as well as free media time on TV. And the debates, I think, have been a very good thing for people. For the most part, they've been structured pretty well, and we've got a good look at the candidates. but also having a certain amount of free airtime so that the candidates can get on the airwaves and make their case to the voters. I mean, you know, it's just simply the case that the broadcasters, the corporate broadcasters, have received their license to broadcast for virtually free. And in return for that, we should ask them to do certain things to enhance democracy in the United States, and that would involve, I believe, making them give a certain amount of airtime to the candidates. This is what all other democracies around the world do, and I don't see why we don't do something like that here in the United States.
Finally, I've talked to somebody in this country that agrees with me. I've been preaching the free airtime for a long time, and I think it'd be the great equalizer. I really do. And maybe take some of the fundraising pressure and all that off of people, and they can get down to issues instead of worrying about rah-rah rallies and raising money.
Absolutely.
I do see that according to polls that have been taken, I think by the Associated Press, that 80% of the people would like to see this whole thing changed.
That's correct. There was a poll done by the AP. What they wanted to what people said was that they'd like to see their state have an opportunity to be the first in the nation status, like New Hampshire and Iowa have, and have New Hampshire and Iowa not have that status so often. So I think there's a tremendous sense on the part of the public, as well as even within the political parties themselves. In fact, both the Democrats and Republicans have said they're going to take a look at the primary process, because this year it really did reach kind of the apotheosis of stupidity, in a sense, you know, 24 states going at once, Florida and Michigan having their being completely disenfranchised in the Democratic nomination process. I mean, it's broken down to the point where even the parties themselves recognize they have to do something, or at least some of them do. Perhaps Terry McAuliffe doesn't. And in fact, in 2000, the Republicans almost came close to adopting the type of plan I described earlier. There was tremendous support for it, but they had to do it through their nominating convention, and Karl Rove, who wasn't necessarily opposed to the idea, wanted an orchestrated pageant at the convention, so he said, "No, we're just not going to do anything like that this year." So they dropped the idea, and now in 2008, they're starting to think about it again. So we may see some change by 2012. We'll see.
I know the folks at the DNC, at least the ones I've talked to, and I did have a chance to talk to several of them very recently. They're not all that convinced that they need to change because, I mean, they know the controversy this year, but because of their stand, the stand that they took in Michigan and Florida, they held fast to it, even being challenged by a lawsuit here in Florida. I just wonder if they're really ready to change. I certainly would hope so after this debacle this year.
Well, it's hard to know how it's going to all work out. If they go to their nominating convention and things are still close between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and suddenly Hillary Clinton is fighting to include the delegates from Florida and Michigan, and Obama is fighting to disenfranchise the voters of Florida and Michigan, Democratic voters, that could be a very, very bitter affair at that point. And then you add into it the superdelegates and the arm twisting that goes on there. Who knows what we may see in the Democratic primary? We'll have a better snapshot tomorrow morning, perhaps, after Super Stupid Tuesday is over. But this may not be the end of the fiasco that we've backed ourselves into because of this chaotic process that we have.
Oh, I think chaotic and fiasco are the proper words that you've just used. Yes. Well, what if you've described the perfect storm there? What if we get to a close convention? And we've got an Obama saying no, don't count them, and Hillary saying yes, do. Imagine, if you will, everybody, imagine the controversy and the upheaval that would cause at convention. I mean, it'd be wow.
And how it would hurt the Democratic nominee.
Oh, yes.
Because, I mean, Florida has played a role into picking the president in each of the last two elections. It's come down to Ohio and Florida, and is there every indication in 2008 it may come down to Ohio and Florida again. So the Democratic nominee cannot afford. It's just hard to imagine how Barack Obama would be able to take a position of not counting the delegates from Florida at that point and still expect that he would somehow win the state of Florida's vote in the Electoral College. So, you know, this is the situation that the Democrats have backed themselves into because of, you know, creating Super Stupid Tuesday. And even if it doesn't turn into the perfect storm this year, it could in another year. It just doesn't make sense to keep it as it is, knowing the possibilities for these perfect storms that could arise.
And then we've got this, what I think is a lopsided mess with the superdelegates. I mean, it's something that's been going on for a long time now. If you will, you're far more proficient at it than I. Can you take just a moment and explain the superdelegate story to our listeners?
Sure. The superdelegates come out of a compromise, if you will, in the 1970s when the Democrats created the primary system for nominations. Prior to that, it was, you know, nominations were much more of a backroom sort of arm-twisting deal. And so the George McGovern forces kind of pushed for the primaries, thinking it would take it out of the backrooms and make it more democratic. The deal that was struck essentially was to graft onto that primary system this superdelegate process, where the superdelegates are party insiders, party leaders. They are elected members of Congress. They are the governors, Democratic governors in the states, and leaders in the Democratic National Committee, who all are a state unto themselves, so to speak. They have their own vote. It's a private vote. They can do what they want with it. They can commit one way and a month later switch to another candidate. You know, they can offer their vote up for favors. I mean, it really does lend itself to more backroom dealing and deal making, which is odd for a party that calls itself by the name Democratic. So here today in 2008, there are about 800 superdelegates, which is about 20% of the total number of delegates in the Democratic convention, and 40% of the number you need to win the nomination. It's a significant number of delegates. The assumption has been that Hillary Clinton, with the help of her husband Bill, would have the inside track on winning more of those superdelegates. And in fact, she is ahead in the superdelegate count at this point by about 100 votes, 100 delegates. And we'll see if that holds up as we move further into this primary process. But again, let's imagine we get to a Democratic convention in the summer where it's still extremely close, nothing's been decided, and suddenly it's going to be decided by these superdelegates, none of them who are known to anybody. The type of backroom deals that, even if it doesn't in fact happen as a result of backroom deals, it's just going to look very, very bad.
You're absolutely right. I know a couple of superdelegates. It has been explained to me, and I won't mention who they are, but if you want to see backroom, smoke-filled room, backroom chicanery and deal-making and politics of the very worst kind, that is exactly what this could foster.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think there's a case to be made, perhaps, for why leaders of the party should have some sort of say to some degree. But that's the big question, is to what degree? And when you give that 40% of the number of delegates needed to win the nomination to those sorts of party insiders, I think at that point you've gone too far in the wrong direction. So I think what they really need to look at is scaling back the number of superdelegates, if not just getting rid of them entirely. I mean, the Republicans have just a handful of superdelegates, maybe 100 out of the couple of thousand of votes of the total number of delegates. So there's on the Republican side, there are actually less potential for this kind of backroom dealing than there is on the Democratic side.
And to shift gears a little bit here and go to a slightly different direction, where do you think we ought to go with the independent? We've got some states that allow independents to vote in the primary. You've got others that don't. It's a big hodgepodge right now. At some of the state, and Florida, you have to be a Democrat to vote in. Independents don't vote in it, but you can cross, you know, you can register. But it's all over the place across the country with that, isn't it?
Yes, there are a number of states that allow independents to vote in their primaries. Or actually, I shouldn't say states. There are a number of states where the parties have allowed, because it's really the party's choice as a result of a Supreme Court ruling to decide who gets to vote in their party's primary. And so in some states, the Democrats, Republicans, and even some of the minor parties have decided to allow independents. But in other states, they say, no, we're not allowing anyone else to vote in our primaries other than voters who have registered to be members of our political party. You know, it's kind of a philosophical question whether the party's nominees should be picked only by people from that party or not. I understand that logic, and to some degree I'm sympathetic with it, but on the other hand, the problem in American politics is that there's so few, you know, legitimate political choices. Most of our elections are so non-competitive that voters are anxious to have their vote count for something, anything. And so that's where the push comes to open up these primaries and allow independent voters to try and to have an influence, because otherwise independent voters in particular, who are basically saying by their independent status they don't feel strongly aligned with any of the political parties, that means the independent voters, the only place where they have a vote is in the general election in November, but there most elections aren't competitive at all. You know, we can tell you right now who's going to win about 85% of the seats in the U.S. House of Representatives in the 2008 elections. And so if that's the only place you get to vote, then, you know, it's almost a luck of the draw whether you live in the handful of districts where there happens to be a competitive race. So, of course, independent voters are anxious to try and have their vote count in as many different elections as possible. It's just very difficult to do in America's winner-take-all electoral system, because most elections just aren't competitive.
Doesn't that open the door for some of the sort of mess that we saw up in Connecticut last time with the Lamont thing? Doesn't that open the door with for Republicans to cross over and influence an election on the Democratic side, should they so choose, and back and forth like that?
It certainly does open the door to do that. I mean, it's not easy to coordinate that sort of thing, but, in the right state at the right time, certainly. I mean, it also opens the door for there have been incidents where, for example, Republican operatives tried to get a Green Party candidate on the ballot in a district where the race was going to be very close, and they were clearly hoping that the Green Party candidate would act as a spoiler to the Democratic candidate and allow the Republican to win with less than a majority of the vote. So these sorts of shenanigans certainly go on in our system as a result of, you know, this geographic-based winner-take-all system where we can figure out with a great deal of certainty the vast majority of races where we could tell you right now who's going to win. And then there's just a handful that are competitive, but they may be, depending on the state or even in the nationally, they may be the races that determine which party controls the majority in that legislature. So as a result, you see all sorts of shenanigans going on where the operatives target their campaigns, target their efforts, target their money raising, and target their messages to the swing voters, you know, slicing and dicing the electorate to try and win a majority or win seats.
Why do you think, in a couple of minutes that we have remaining here, why do you think there's been this huge coverage, this massive coverage of this year? Has it been driven by the parties themselves, or has it been driven, in your opinion, by the press needing wanting to drive the story, wanting to make news?
Well, I think there's a sense that the country is in the mood for a change after 7 years of the Bush administration. I think you have more voters engaged just on their own without the media hype that certainly is going on. And so the media is kind of piggybacking on that. They see an opportunity to, you know, create some headlines, sell TV ads. I mean, keep in mind that the corporate broadcasters, in the way, you know, going back to what we talked about earlier, the way it's structured, they have incentive to not really have much in the way of substantive political coverage, and in a sense of allowing candidates to say what they think about the issues and what have you, but instead to just cover the horse race. And that's what they do extremely well. I mean, they cover politics like it's a sporting event. And, you know, Hillary Clinton crying, and Barack Obama, the insurgent campaign, and Fred Thompson coming from out of nowhere, a former actor. I mean, they're really good at these sorts of things. But it's on the substantive issues where they don't really cover these candidates, because that forces these candidates then to buy more TV ads. And so the broadcasters actually have a bottom-line incentive to cover politics substantively less and less, covering the horse race more and more, and forcing the politicians, the candidates, to buy these TV ads in order to be able to communicate with the public in any substantive way. So it's kind of a complex picture about why the media does what it does. And a lot of it is driven by just these bottom-line considerations.
Well, maybe that's what the public wants. Maybe the public wants nothing more than political Britney Spears stories. I don't know. I'm fascinated by the haircut stories and the crying stories and the little meaningless stories that make the news all the time when there are substantive issues that need to be discussed. But you're absolutely right. And tonight we're in for a smorgasbord of political. I don't know what tonight. They're just going to be blathering all over the place from now until what, 2 o'clock in the morning, I suppose, tonight. So I warned everybody to get their popcorn ready and get ready for a long
evening. Coverage is what they. This is the type of thing they do well. It's leading up to it.
Oh yes, all sorts of crawls across the bottom of the screen, three at once, whatever. It'll be terrible. Well,
which creates a great niche for shows like yourself, where you do have the time for guests to come on and talk substantively about issues. I mean, it's hopefully as many people as possible are getting their news from shows like yours, and not just from the big major networks.
Well, that's our niche, and our listeners are highly informed, substantive issue people, and we know that, and that's what they want. They don't want Britney Spears stories. They want meat, and that's what we try and give them. So, Steven, I want you to thank you so much for being on the program today. Your website, newamerica.net.
That's correct, and there's a website for my book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, which is just simply www.10steps.net. That's 10steps.net, and I go into a lot of the different ways that we really need to look at in order, in terms of making our democracy work better.
Well, we have much work to be done, many issues to cover along the primary, but maybe with a little luck and a little wisdom, we'll get it done. Stephen, thanks so much for being on the program today. We appreciate it so very much.
My pleasure, Guy.
Stephen Hill, newamerica.net, an interesting man. What he knows about the primary, well, it isn't worth knowing, I guess. But many, many things to iron out on the primaries. Many, many, many things to iron out with these primaries. This thing today, again, I was going to do a whole show, and I think I may have mentioned this the other day. I was going to do a whole show where we sat down and explained each and every state how they cut up their delegates. Well, not actually cut them up, but how they figured who won what delegates. And the more I got into it, the more I understood that we would have people's heads spinning at the end of the day. Not that you couldn't eventually understand it, because our listeners, I know, are far more intelligent than the people that watch some of these shows on TV. Now, this much we know. But it's just hard to explain the whole thing, the division of delegates, the superdelegate thing. Yeah, Stephen did a good job of explaining the superdelegates, and I do know a couple of superdelegates, and they have told me that if you want to see real down and dirty, those are the exact words, down and dirty political dealing go on, just wait until we have a close campaign and we get in the back rooms of the convention and it's close and somebody needs these superdelegates. You wait and see what the arm twisting that'll go on. Hey, I'll make you Secretary of State. You'll be an ambassador. Your child will do that. You wait. That is exactly what will happen. And so we have to. I think it would be a great idea to diminish the importance of the superdelegates and have more and more just regular single voting delegates, ordinary delegates, people like you and me that go from the party to have the more influence than they do now. The superdelegate thing, I can understand a little bit of it, but they've got far too much power right now, and I don't like to see that much of the power. After all, this is a democracy. For all the people, not just a few, and we have to remember that. Well, here we have an hour gone in the program already. Where did it go? We're going to stop for news right now here in the Guy James Show, Head On Radio Network. Music director Billy Shears, and we'll be back right after the news, and we hope you'll be with us as well.
Tonight's news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
Statistics compiled by the International Stabilization Force in Afghanistan show attacks on international troops and the Afghan government have gone up between a fifth and a third. The conservative Washington think tank American Enterprise Institute that devised the surge in Iraq has come up with a plan to send 12,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. Russia's ambassador to NATO warned Sunday of a new confrontation between Warsaw and Moscow over plans by the U.S. to base missiles in Eastern Europe. The New York Times reports that the latest environmentally friendly community is not in Portland, Oregon, but in the Persian Gulf. Groundbreaking is scheduled Saturday for Masdar City, a nearly self-contained municipality designed for up to 50,000 people in Abu Dhabi. The 2.3 square mile community, set behind walls to divert hot desert winds and airport noise, will be car-free, according to the design by the London firm of Foster & Partners, a leading practitioner of energy-saving architecture. Property manager Khalid Awad said the community, slightly smaller than the historic district of Venice, will have similar narrow pedestrian streets but shaded by canopies made of photovoltaic panels. It will produce all of its own energy from sunlight. Water will flow from a solar-powered seawater desalination plant. Produce will come from nearby greenhouses, and all waste will be composted or otherwise recycled. Since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, many women have been executed, assaulted, raped, or released only after their families paid ransom money. Serious threats and deadly attacks have forced Christians and Muslims to wear the veil, quit their jobs, and avoid makeup and education. In 1987, 75% of Iraqi women were literate, but by 2000, only 25% were. Women in Iraq today talk about the good old days of Saddam, when women could safely go to work, socialize, or take part in politics. Under Saddam's regime, there was compulsory free education up to the highest level. There was also free hospitalization. In 1991, more than 100,000 Iraqis were killed during the Gulf War. Afterwards, millions of people, mainly young children, died as a result of the U.S.-led blockade. The lack of food and medicine, along with the deteriorating sanitary conditions, caused one-fifth of the population to starve to death.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch!
Throw it, I say! Throw it!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, do you hear me? Give my creation!
This was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. I hope you all dump your stock portfolio this morning. Oh, my God. The Dow is down $369. I don't know if that's the final, or 369 points, rather. I don't know if that's the final. It appears that it is. 369.13 down for the day. Whoa. Oil even went down, 88.4. You know, we hear all these stories all the time, excuses. Well, you know, we had problems in the Straits of Hormuz today, and, you know, the oil was driven up $3 a barrel, or someone was threatened here. This country had, you know, rattled a saber, and the oil went up. I heard the best one yet. What was it, Saturday? Friday. Now, wait a minute. What date? I don't have a date on it. It must have been yesterday. Best excuse I've heard yet for raising oil prices. They went up $1 a barrel. They blamed it. The marketers blamed it on fog in Houston. That's right. Oil went up $1 a barrel. It must have been yesterday because they said it went up because of fog in Houston, that there was so much fog they couldn't get all the tankers unloaded the way they normally do, and so they had to raise the price $1 a barrel. Oh, man, any port in a storm, I guess. Wow. I see we have more endorsements today. I forget who else I heard. I was going to make a note of it. Endorsements. Please spare me the endorsements. Honestly, now, I mean, some of you might not agree with me. Maybe nobody will agree with me. I just have to say something about it. And I fully realize that I'm the exception here. I know that. In fact, I don't think I know another single person who feels as passionately about this as I do. But I just, I've got to say something about the candidates running out and getting celebrity endorsements and having them surround them at political events and speeches and so forth. I just hate it. I hate it. I cringe when I see the likes of an Oprah or a Robert De Niro or the Kennedys or Barbara Streisand or Chuck Norris, for God's sake, Hulk Hogan, Spielberg, Tim Robbins, and on and on and on and on. Honestly, I think grabbing celebrity endorsements looks cheap. And maybe none of you agree with me. I fully realize that these window dressings, and that's what they are to me, that maybe they matter to some people, evidently a whole lot of people, or they probably wouldn't do it. But for the life of me, I cannot understand why anyone would care even a little bit who one of these Hollywood creatures wants for president. Why should their approval of a candidate mean a damn thing more than your neighbor's opinion? I mean, why? Somebody explain it to me. I don't get it. Why does Robert De Niro's choice for president matter to anybody but himself? He's an actor, for God's sake. He doesn't even live in the real world. I mean, he's a good actor. I know a good plumber. I don't give a damn what the plumber thinks about the race. I don't go out and ask for his endorsement. I don't give a damn about Robert De Niro's. And Hulk Hogan, I see him. Does this matters to people? I mean, I fully realize that lots of people love the Hulkster. but do they like him for his intellectual proclivities? Really? I mean, honestly, I know Steven Spielberg's a smart guy, and he knows how to make good movies, but why in the world would his choice of presidential candidates mean anything whatsoever to me? I'm my own man. I have a brain. Democracy means people power, not star power. Help me get it, will you? Frankly, I don't care if any of the candidates, you know, if any of them have the endorsement of Robert De Niro or Streisand or the Pope or Tinky Winky or Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs for that. It doesn't matter to me what someone else thinks. It's my vote. It's my decision, and I'll make it myself, thank you. And you can take all your Hollywood actors, and you can... I do not care. And I see some of the Kennedys are for Obama, and some of the Kennedys are for Hillary. I don't give a damn. I have no reason to give a damn what the Kennedys think. I admire the Kennedys. I do not care who they want for president. It matters not to me. Am I being selfish? Am I being self-centered? I don't know. But my old coach in high school taught me that, you know, I don't care who it is. They put their pants on the same way you do every day. There isn't a single soul on this planet that's better than you are. I have always believed that. And so I look at the, you know, celebrity endorsements for anything. And, you know, I have to tell you how stubborn I am about this. And I know, you're going to say, you know, he's really weird. I would not wear a piece of clothing or buy a product that has a celebrity endorsement knowingly. I mean, if I knew somebody endorsed, I wouldn't do it. Would not do it. I refuse to play that game. Maybe I have unknowingly bought, I don't know, a car, a radio, a bag of groceries that somebody endorsed, but not if I knew it. I mean, I've seen this, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, what does she sell, perfume or something? I'm trying to think of some other celebrity endorsements. I can't think of any right now, but it just galls me. It really does. I guess you know by now I don't think all that much of Hollywood. Let's pause. Let's go to the phone. Let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy. This is John from Fort Myers.
Hi, John.
I like what you're saying about the celebrity endorsements. It really is true. And, of course, it goes further than that. It's like the folks who sit down and watch TV in the evening and somebody's got left-leaning tendencies and they like Keith Olbermann, and somebody's got right-leaning tendencies and they like to watch Bill O'Reilly or something like that. And so those two same people might live across the street from each other. They're subject to the same local issues as far as taxation, police enforcement, all of those things. They've got all those things in common, and yet they allow themselves to be divided by people who live a long ways away, who live in houses we can't afford, who have car service come up and pick them up and take them into work, who eat in restaurants that we couldn't. They have more in common with each other than they have in common with us. And for all of our political divisions locally, politically, we do have a lot in common with each other. And I think we forget that much. Whatever bumper sticker you have on your car, it doesn't change the fact that the school boards affect us locally the same way. The utilities, the local taxation, all of that, these are things we share in common, and yet somehow we find ourselves identifying with people who live a long ways from us, don't suffer the same things that we do every day, live lives that we could barely imagine, and have more in common with each other, and probably are a lot more collegial with each other behind the scenes when the lights go off in the studio than we would even imagine.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. Can you put, I know, well, I can tell from listening to you, you're sitting on your sofa at home, you turn into the evening news and you see, one of these celebrities, Robert De Niro, and he says, I'm for so-and-so. Can you imagine sitting there and saying, Shazam! Robert De Niro's for this guy. I'm going to have to go for him.
Right.
It's fascinating to me. It is.
I would make one exception in the celebrity endorsement, and that is if it's a celebrity who has been both in terms of time and sweat and the checkbook been involved in political activity outside the, you know, endorsement during a presidential or a senatorial campaign or what have you. If it's somebody who has been out there and has been really pushing a particular issue and working hard on that issue, then I'd say, you know, maybe their endorsement means something, because obviously this is a person that takes politics seriously. At least I think I'm willing to listen to what they have to say. But like you say, if it's just somebody who just pops up who has no political profile whatsoever, other than, like you say, standing beside a candidate at a podium at some rally, and everybody says, "Well, I like that actor. I'm going to vote for the guy. He's standing beside that. It is that. It's true. That's, you know, it is a politics almost without substance when it gets to that point. I mean, I think there are some people out there that, whether you agree with them or not politically, you have to respect their continued involvement, like Sean Penn would be one. I mean, people may disagree vociferously with the positions that he takes, but he's constantly out there pitching.
I can name you one that if an issue came up about New Orleans, I would certainly listen to him. Is this actor, what's his name? He's been down there building houses and putting up a ton of his own money. I'm so bad about Brad Pitt.
Yes.
He's spent a considerable amount of his own money. He's been down there. He's been swinging a hammer. He's actually been swinging a hammer. And he's been quite an activist for the people of New Orleans. Well, if an issue comes up about New Orleans, I'll listen to him.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, exactly. I remember a celebrity endorsement, and I, at the time, I mean, I was a teenager, but this was back in the 68 election when George Wallace was president. I remember the only celebrity endorsement I remember him getting was Hank Snow. He's a country western singer.
Hank Snow.
Yeah, that'll sure take him over the top, you know, having Hank Snow in his corner.
Oh, man, Hank Snow for George Wallace.
I'm sure he has other celebrities out there, but that's the only one I remember standing beside him. I thought, geez, I mean, this guy was a has been in 1968. I mean, Wallace must have been fishing for celebrities.
Yeah, maybe he could have got Scruggs and Flat too. I don't know. Hank Snow, I did not know that for George Wallace. Oh, yeah, man. I met George Wallace one time on the campus down at Ohio State. It was interesting anyway. Yeah, I did. But I tell you, I am most impressed when you tell me that Hank Snow was for him.
Well, yeah, it changes your whole outlook, doesn't it?
It certainly does. That's rich.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, John. Great call.
Have a great day. All right, bye-bye.
Hank Snow for George Wallace. Someday I'll have to tell you my George Wallace story. I probably couldn't without offending a few people. Certainly not. Not that I would want to offend you, but you would be offended if you heard what George Wallace said. Anyway, coming up in about 10 minutes or so, we've got Francis Piven. Francis from worldtraveler.com, thirdworldtraveler.com. We're going to talk about the new Bush budget, and isn't it exciting? Sweet. We'll talk to her about that. I know all of you have heard this war going on about the pundits from the left wing that hate John McCain. You know, I've asked people for a long time and not gotten any real hate mail about it. I think I want to ask on my right-wing friends, and I know I'll probably hear from some of you maybe, I hope. Would someone want to tell me how it is that Mitt Romney, who was a liberal governor of a liberal state, how he is somehow suddenly more conservative than John McCain. I would really love to have the answer to that one. Is there any evidence whatsoever? I'm not saying about what he says, but I want to know about things he has done. Forget his mouth. Tell me things he has done. Give me some evidence that Romney is your big-ass conservative while John McCain is some sort of a liberal. This is coming from the right, these people. I mean, you... And don't do it by telling me that what McCain has done to be liberal. Tell me what Romney has done to be a conservative. I would like to know. I cannot think of anything that Romney hasn't flipped on in order to run for the presidency. I can't think of anything where he has been an arch conservative, and yet you've got your Limbaughs and all these people just whooping it up. Oh my God, we've got to have our conservative, and you've got no such thing running for the presidency. You don't have an arch conservative running for the presidency, and that is what almost every one of these political hacks is praying for. And frankly, neither of them, neither McCain or Romney, fit the bill at all. And they're going to go to the polls and they're going to vote for this guy, one of them. And it will be interesting to see how that turns out today. It really will. I wouldn't want to bet on how that comes out today, but I think most likely McCain's going to be the nominee after tonight. I suppose there's a few places Romney. Will it make a difference on these right wing talkers? I mean, it's right down the line too. I had a list here someplace. I don't know what I did with it. Man, I'm good at losing my list. You know, you just go down the line. Every doggone one of them, they don't want McCain. And they've been vociferous about it. I mean, they've been doggone mean about it. Why they didn't want John McCain to be their candidate. I've never seen anything quite like it. I didn't think I ever would see anything quite like it. You know, Limbaugh and Hannity and just one after another, seems odd to me. And they've been so nasty about it, I don't really see how they can go back. Under normal circumstances, I might understand, well, you know, we had our differences during the primary, but, man, there's some of these people swearing that they can't ever go for John McCain, and how could they possibly vote for John McCain after telling everybody, the millions of people that listen to him, that he's a liberal? He's a no-good turncoat liberal. And that's what they're saying. And frankly, some of that's pretty mild. Hannity, Limbaugh, Hugh Hewitt. Oh, Jesus, especially Hugh Hewitt. Mark Levin. Michael Savage. Laura Ingraham. I don't know I don't know of a one that... That isn't swearing they can't vote for McCain. I find this really interesting. Don't know that I've ever seen anything quite like it before. We've got just a few minutes until we have our next guest on. We're going to have Francis Piven on from thirdworldtraveler.com, and we're going to talk about this new budget of Bush's. And once again, taking public money... targeted for services to the masses and thrown it toward the military, the big contractors, and so forth. I did find some myths. We're still on this Super Tuesday thing for a little bit. Some myths about Super Tuesday. A lot of people think that the majority of the delegates will be selected after today. That is not true. Almost every major media outlet is trumped up that charge, but it's just not true. Actually, only 42% of the delegates will be selected on Super Tuesday. So that's not going to happen. The media is reporting the number of delegates who reside in Super Tuesday states. In fact, more than half. But 400 of these are superdelegates who get a ticket to Denver irrespective of the outcome of the voting, and they are not bound to reflect the views of the voters in their state, and they will make backroom deals. And more than one media outlet's already counting superdelegates from these states in its running tallies, and hey, they can change any time they want to. If they get a better deal from another candidate, they can and they will change their vote, these superdelegates. A lot of people think that the early voting is making a difference. It is not. They found here in Florida that a lot of people, you know, they said, well, they've wasted their votes. They might have voted a long time ago in early voting, and since then their candidate, you know, candidacy has become irrelevant. Not true. The early voters in Florida, at least, voted in the last couple of weeks. So that isn't necessarily true. And the race may not be settled on February 5th. In fact, I don't think it will be. They're talking about momentum being a myth. I don't think that is true. I think Obama has tremendous momentum right now. And that is not to be discounted, I don't think. And one of the other myths is it's just a few big states that matter the most. In fact, the states that will matter most come Tuesday are those in which one candidate manages to get a big margin in. And if Hillary and Obama, for example, divide California, 370 delegates evenly between them, then picking up 10 extra Clinton delegates in Oklahoma or 20 for Obama in Georgia might make all the difference in the world. So it's not necessarily true what they're saying about the big states. Winning 55% of the 370 delegates in California is obviously better than winning the same percentage of you know, 38. But, well, it'll all shake out tonight, and I know several Coca-Colas and a bag of chips later, or maybe several beers and some pretzels. I don't know what your favorite is, but it'll all be sorted out tonight sometime, and we will not have, at least I'm predicting on the Democratic side, we will not have a clear-cut candidate by the time this evening is over. I would be shocked if that were true. I really would. What do you think? We're going to pause for a break right now. We'll be right back.
Ticket to anywhere, maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere, any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove. You got a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living. See, my old man's got a problem. Yeah, but the bottle, that's the way it is. He says his body's too old for working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more from life than he could give. I said, somebody's got to take care of him. So I quit school, and that's what I did. You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so we can fly away? We gotta make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way. So I remember when we were driving in your car. Speed so fast, I felt like I was drunk. City lights day out before us, and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged.
got a fast car. We go cruise and entertain ourselves. Still ain't got a job. Now work in the market as a checkout girl. I know things will get better. You'll find work and I'll get promoted. We'll move out of the shelter. Buy a bigger house and live in the suburbs. I remember when we were driving in your car. Speed so fast, it felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us. Your arm felt nice, wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. And we've got about a half hour left in the program, and so glad you've all decided to join us this afternoon, having a great discussion, as always. And as promised, right now I have Frances Fox Piven on the program. She is has a website, thirdworldtraveler.com, and very interesting piece up on there. Well, we asked Frances to come on the program today to talk about the new Bush budget and she's got a book out called The War at Home, and it certainly seems to me this new budget reflects a war that we have going on. Frances, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Guy.
We do have a war going on at home, and it's with this budget. And it's a war pretty much between the Pentagon and the rest of us. Is that the way you see it as well?
Well, it is between the Pentagon and the rest of us. But I think it's also between the conservative movement, especially its business wing, and the rest of us. And there's an overlap between the Pentagon and business conservatives, particularly the Sunbelt-based conservatives who are into oil and firms like Halliburton. The nature of the war is that they have been, you know, a budget is a document that shows who is going to get what in government effort and the revenue from the revenues that we provide government, and who's going to pay and who's going to get. This budget shows that the military is going to get a lot, and I absolutely agree with you, and that the programs which reach many, many millions of Americans, like Medicare, for example, are going to get cut. So in a simple sense, you can see the Pentagon's taking it, and old people, sick people, are going to suffer as a consequence. But it's a little more than that. Think, for example, of the huge tax cuts that Bush wants to make permanent. Those are the tax cuts on the very most affluent people in the United States. And if they are made permanent, we're talking now about more trillions of dollars. Nobody knows what $1 trillion is. How can you get your mind around $1 trillion? Well, $1 trillion would fix Medicare, would fix Social Security. It would make it possible for us to give Medicaid to all the low-income children in the country and to their parents as well. $1 trillion could repair our bridges. It would make it possible for us to secure our ports, our reservoirs, because the Homeland Security Department hasn't done that yet. So it's not just the Pentagon versus the rest of us. I think it's the business-backed conservative movement and its Pentagon allies against the rest of us.
Oh, certainly, and you're right. It does go farther. We talked about earlier about the war being about oil. Well, it's so much more. It is interconnected. It's not just oil. It's the entire infrastructure of the country. It's about all of our government services. I mean, this war, for example, that we've got going on, and all the money being poured into the Pentagon is sucking services dry from the whole rest of the country. So it's far more than just oil, just like you said. And you're right about the Southern conservatives certainly getting their fair share of it, far more than their fair share. And, you know, and talking about taxes, I wonder if anybody has thought about the folly of what it would have been like if during the Second World War, Franklin Roosevelt would have said, we're going to cut the taxes on the wealthy. We're in a war. Let's cut taxes. I don't think I've ever heard of anything as ridiculous as that.
Absolutely not. The marginal tax rate went up for the rich in the United States went up to 90% during World War II. And everybody took it for granted that that was the right thing to do, that everybody was making an effort, that young men and women were going overseas, were risking life and limb, women were in the war industries. Everybody was making a sacrifice, and it was only right that the rich should do their share.
Right, share. That's the word. And there's been no use of that word since the Iraq War got started. We were talking earlier today. Today's the fifth anniversary of Colin Powell going before the United Nations and making this statement. Well, there's many untrue statements that he made that day, but it's caused, with no sacrifice coming from almost everybody. I mean, everybody's making the sacrifices over there now, but I think the entire country is going to sacrifice here pretty soon with the like you said, the loss in services of Medicaid, Medicare, our Social Security is going to suffer, everything, $1 trillion. You know, it's hard to put your mind around a billion, and when you think of $1,000 billion,
that's right, yeah.
Trillion. Your book, A War at Home, The Domestic Costs of Bush's Militarism, you mentioned in it that America's wealth is being redirected toward the military and the rich. Why do you think that the rest of us are just sitting by apathetically and allowing this to happen?
Well, you know, people have turned against the war in the last couple of years. But at the beginning of the war, you know, war is, at least for a while, is an opportunity for government leaders to really deceive people, because war is about foreign threats, and nobody experiences those threats directly. How do we assess a foreign threat? How do we know if there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? We listen to our leaders. We rely on them to interpret a reality which we can't see, hear, or smell. And this is an opportunity, really, for mass deception on a very large scale. That's one reason. The other reason is that, you know, we all get excited by war. We're patriots. We love our country. We the people, the flag, the nation. And those feelings are easily stirred up when we think that there is a foreign menace out there. And those feelings were stirred up a lot by the Bush administration. And very sort of cheap thrills. The flight jacket on the aircraft carrier, mission accomplished, that sort of nonsense. It was a lie. But people do get excited and pleased by that. It's a vulnerability that we all have as humans, I feel, our identification.
As witnessed by the 90% approval rate he had
right
at that time. And he squandered that.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah, it was 27 in the latest CBS poll, is tying his all-time low. But you're right, the little flags flying from everybody's cars, and you know those little stickers that stuck up, and the ribbons everybody had on the back, and support our troops and all this. America was drawn right into that thing, and he obviously had planned it a long time before 9/11. He wanted a piece of Saddam Hussein, and this just all worked out very, very nicely for him and, as Eisenhower put it, the military-industrial complex.
Well, it worked out for a while. I mean, he won a few elections on that tide of excitement and approval, but it was a crazy policy. It was so reckless. It destroyed our relations with other countries. It made the United States a pariah in the world, and it also depleted our resources so that we now have a fragile infrastructure. We have regulatory agencies like the Food and Drug Administration which can't regulate, can't monitor, can't investigate because they've been stripped of resources, both for the tax cuts and for the war. So, it was like driving us over a cliff, and we may not have seen the worst of it yet.
I'm so afraid you're absolutely right. I don't think we've come close to seeing the worst of it yet, and I don't think the American public understands just how far that we may have to fall yet, and I hope I'm dead wrong on that. I would certainly like to be wrong on that, but it doesn't look like we're going to be. But you're right. The militarism, he took that for granted that he could do it, and he did it successfully, him and Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld and a plethora of others, and took full advantage of the American public. And you're right. Our American prestige around the world, we have become a pariah. We get callers to this program from other countries. And I live in an area where there are many people visit from other countries, and I'm sad to report that our stead with people around the world has dropped tremendously in the last 5 years, and I'm frankly embarrassed by it.
Yeah, well, for good reason, though. I can still remember the two or three decades after World War II when the United States took enormous pride in being the most democratic nation in the world. I mean, it was a very flawed democracy, mind you, but nevertheless, we had that democratic confidence. And the rest of the world looked to us as a kind of beacon of democracy. And now we're torturers.
Right.
We throw people in prison without ground. We murder them. This is such an incredible transformation, both of the American reality and the American image. Now, I don't want to misstate the truth of the past. There were terrible things going on in this country, our criminal justice system, the treatment of African Americans, and so forth and so on. But there was some reason for the democratic glow of the decades after World War II. And that reason is now gone.
Yes. Yes, it is. And, our great middle class is disappearing along with our prestige. And I think when the great middle class is gone, the heart and soul of the country will be gone. And we're seeing it more and more and more every day with, the housing market. And we're paying the price right now. We certainly are for this war. And I don't think a lot of people have associated I don't think a lot of people put the pieces to the puzzle together. What's your answer to all this? How do you think we can get back to being where we were with our respect? And I know that's a big question.
Well, there's a lot that has to change. For one thing, we have to restore our ability to have a progressive tax system without revenues and revenues that come from those who can afford it. Government can't do very much. We have to restore our regulatory agencies. Those regulatory agencies, it took a century of struggle of popular movements, of advocacy groups worried about poisoned meat and poisoned air to get those regulatory agencies, and they have been stripped bare. Now, by the Reagan administration, Clinton didn't do that much to restore them, and now by the Bush administration. So we have to restore our regulatory capacity, our taxing capacity. We have to develop a publicly accountable healthcare system. That means that the politicians have to take on the big pharmaceutical companies. You can't do it if you don't take on the pharmaceuticals and the HMOs. We have to restore the programs that put a safety net under the bottom of the people who are worst off in our society, like unemployment insurance, food stamps. We even should have a welfare program again. We took away welfare and we took away a lot of unemployment insurance at the same time, and we left nothing in its stead. We have those those programs, maybe they can be improved, but taking them away is not improving them. It's leaving people exposed, people who are the most vulnerable, who have the fewest resources to cope. It leaves them exposed to the exigencies of the marketplace. And no contemporary rich society does that to the extent that we do it in the United States.
Well, of course, we're about to have this stimulus package, you know, and everybody's going to get $200 or $300, and that's just going to make it all okay. Not that everybody couldn't use a good $300, but that's the typical politician's way of doing everything. Here you go. Here's $300. That'll make it all okay now. And forget that we took away the unemployment, and forget we took away the help with food stamps and all that. Here's $300, and that'll make it all okay. And it's kind of a shame, really.
It is a shame, because a good stimulus package would, I think, take the form of restoring many of the programs for the most vulnerable people that have been so damaged in the last 25 years.
Yes, yes. Francis, I want to thank you so much. Your website is thirdworldtraveler.com, right?
No, it's not my website.
Okay.
They did pick up a comment that I made. I don't have a website.
Okay. Well, they can... All right. Yeah, I've got that crossed up here. Yeah, you can find a good bit of what Francis has written over at thirdworldtraveler.com. Got a good piece there from the trying to think of the title of that one.
The Institute for Public Accuracy piece?
The War at Home, The Domestic Cost of Bush's Militarism. I think a lot of people will find that very interesting, and you also have
that's the book.
Yeah.
And I have a newer book, too. Can I tell your
audience? Yes, most certainly. Please do.
I have a new book called Challenging Authority, How Ordinary People Change America. And it's about the role of protest movements from the revolutionary era up to today in making the United States a more humane and equal society.
I would like to read that, too. A lot of people think... A lot of people think our protest started with the Vietnam War.
Right.
They really do. And, well, that's the first recollection of many people anyway. Once again, the book title?
Challenging Authority, How Ordinary People Change America.
And available where?
I think it's available at most big bookstores.
Okay.
It's published by Roman Littlefield, and I know you can get it on Amazon.com.
Okay. All right. Very good. Francis, thank you very much for being on the program today. I appreciate hearing your insight.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Francis Fox Piven, check out that article on thirdworldtraveler.com. Always interesting. Very, very good piece. Very, very intelligent. Very intelligent lady. We're going to pause for a break right now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Money, a whole lot of spending money. It's gonna take plenty of money.
the clock is winding down on the show today. Where did the time go? I'm assuming that most of you by now have taken a look at the Bush $3.1 trillion budget. It is a disaster. Figured it would be top heavy with military spending, not even counting the increase in the Iraq war spending. Funny how they like to hide that. But it is funny, isn't it? I've grown accustomed to hearing Republicans talking about Democrats as the tax and spend liberals. And here we have Junior Bush that's taken a budget that was mostly balanced, and through his ridiculous tax cuts and wild, unchecked spending, has brought us back world-class budget deficits. We're talking about big, nasty record deficits. And, you know, we had Clinton in office. Blame it on who you want to, whether it was him, the Republican Congress, no matter who, but they did bring the budget under control. And Junior has completely thrown all of that out the window. All the efforts by the Clinton administration to reduce that burden and that we're placing on future generations, and thrown it right back on there again. And it never ceases to amaze me. We seem to have enough money to pour into the war in Iraq. We have unlimited funds to pour into Iraq, a war that we don't want. And yet we don't have enough money to take care of things here at home. We veto a CHIPS program. We can kill all the people in Iraq that we want to, and we got all the money that we need to do that, but we don't have enough money to take care of our kids here at home. He vetoes something like that. And instead of looking how to more effectively deliver the services that we need here in this country for our people and social programs so that we can do the greatest good with the amount of money that we have, the budget goes in the opposite direction. And isn't it crazy? If you read this budget, you see he's calling for a balanced budget by the year 2012, 4 years after the end of his term. He doesn't want to face the music now. He doesn't want to face the responsibility, the party of responsibility, you know, for all this irresponsible fiscal policy. And he's dumping it all on the next president. He's jumping a huge, huge fiscal spending mess into their lap along with this war. Massive problems being dumped right into, and he knows it. He knows it. That's why it's such a shame when they had a chance to impeach the guy that should have done it. Should have done it. Don't know why they didn't. Big mistake. Huge mistake not to have impeached this man when the door was open for it. I'm afraid it's closed now. I just hope people in Congress have the good sense to at least call him into account for the things they've done and make an issue of it and make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again in this country. It would be a shame to repeat the mistakes of the Bush administration ever. Ever, ever, ever. Well, thanks for joining us today here in the Guy James Show. Don't forget, we are a listener-supported program, and we need your support right now. It's that time of year, folks. You've been listening to the Guy James Show and the Head On Radio Network. Thanks to Billy Shears, our music director. Thanks to all of you for listening. And don't you dare forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.